everybody. How's it going? Welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Wes, and I'm here, as always, with the wonderful Ben. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, Wes?
I'm doing great. Feels like it's been a while since we've recorded. You know, we're still in the thick of it with research and also just busy in our real lives, but it's good to be back. Yeah, happy to be here, man.
I know. I'm ready to play some games again. It's been too long. I've just been in the thick of research, and it's not always good. It's a lot of tic-tac-toe.
It's a lot of tic-tac-toe. Yeah, yeah. Not as many noughts and crosses, but, you know, I guess that's the same thing, isn't it? Never mind.
It is, yeah. That's what the people in the UK call it.
Right, yeah, yeah. But we do have some good games to talk about today, but before we get into our episode, our timeline, got to catch up on what we've been playing recently. You have anything you want to talk about today, Ben?
I'm like in one of those moods. I've been kind of floating between like seven different games, you know?
Sure. Okay.
But I guess the one I'll talk about for today is I've been getting back into Rocksmith again. It seems to be like every year, you know, into it for a little while. But for those of you who don't know, it's like Guitar Hero, but for a real guitar, kind of basically. It's basically just you play along the tabs and it just keeps track of how many notes you hit. I'm approaching a couple like kind of big milestones. So I thought it was a good time to talk about it again. For one thing, I'm getting close to, I think I told you before, I was trying to 99% as many songs as I could.
Right, yeah.
And whenever I do 99% a song, I remove it from my kind of playlist and I'll throw in a new song. And I'm getting close to having completed 499%.
Wow.
I think it's pretty cool.
Impressive. Yeah.
So lots of songs. Mostly I've only played once or twice, but yeah, so that's one cool thing. And then the other thing is the songs that I've been kind of replacing anything on 99%, it's from this list that's created by the community. Every week they have this kind of like championship is what they call it, but it's basically like a high score challenge for the week. And they divide kind of the buckets of talent for their community players into different tiers. So I've been doing all the easy tier songs, and that's why I've been able to 99% so many. But I started when they started this weekly competition, which was in 2014, right? And it's been going every week since then, over 10 years. And I think right now they're at week 620, something like that, for current day. And I've gone through about 600. So wow. I'm almost caught up to current day. The reason why that number is so much higher than the 99% number is because they have duplicates often. But yeah, so it would be cool to catch up to current day. Then I could actually like submit my own scores for the weekly competition, which I think might be kind of fun. So that's kind of approaching. I also thought it might be kind of funny to talk about my rank. I don't think I've ever talked about this, but I use this like third-party software that tracks my high scores and submits them to a leaderboard. I haven't had the third-party software active the whole time I've played, so I'm not sure exactly how many of my 99% have been tracked, but I'm currently ranked number 56 in the world for lead guitar, which I'm pretty happy
wow,
about.
Wow, okay, nice. That's everyone who's registered with that software. That's crazy.
Yeah. But what's crazy is that my score, right, which I don't really know how the score is calculated, to be fair. I think it's something like you get so many points if you like get like, let's say, first place on a song, but then you get more points if there's more people who have played that song. So like if you do really good on a very popular song, you get a lot of points, which obviously I haven't been trying to do popular songs or anything. But yeah, I've got 613 points. But the person in first place has 34,000 points. It's like, oh my God, they must play Rocksmith like every day, you know, nonstop. That's crazy. I mean, I have, let's check Steam for a second. I think I have like 350 hours in Rocksmith. And I only have 600 points. So yeah, 34,000 points. How does that happen? You must be pretty good at guitar. Yeah, I've got 373 hours played.
Impressive, so, yeah.
We're getting there. But yeah, that's kind of what I've been up to. Some kind of milestones approaching. I should be able to get to the 400 songs and get caught up with present day probably this week. And then my plan is to go back through their weekly competitions again, but this time on the intermediate songs instead of the easy ones. We'll probably slow down a lot, but that's okay.
Nice. Very cool. Well, yeah, you'll have to let us know when you hit that milestone and when you start on the intermediate. So I'm excited. Some good progress.
Yeah, man. But that's what I've been up to. What have you been up to?
Well, I've got a couple things to talk about, but a while ago, I've wrapped up a game that I started talking about a couple episodes ago, Hearts of Stone, the DLC for Witcher 3.
Mm-hmm.
Finally finished that. Well, shouldn't say finally. It was only a 10-hour DLC. It just took me forever to get around to beating it. But the story wrapped up really cool. I mean, there's this sort of evil trickster character who binds people in pacts that you meet at the very beginning. He sort of like follows you through the whole arc, and there's sort of a confrontation at the end of it, but it's very interesting because it's not your typical like boss fight. It's more like a puzzle fight. And
okay,
the way they do the visuals for it, the like stuff you have to do during it, and kind of like the dialogue that happens because he's sort of taunting you the whole time you're going through this challenge that he's set up. It's all very, very cool. Super well done. So I enjoyed that one a lot. And I started on the next DLC, Blood and Wine, which this one is the first one I mentioned before, but it's kind of like is a small expansion on the area already existing in the game. This one, Blood and Wine, adds a whole new area to the game, and apparently it's about like 30 to 40 hours of content if you do all the side quests.
Okay.
And it's very different from the rest of the game because you're in like this beautiful countryside where they have these like knights in gleaming armor and they produce wine, so there's wineries everywhere, and it's just very bright compared to the rest of Witcher 3, which is very dark and gloomy most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't gotten too far in it so far, but already there's like feels like more new monster types than there were in the first DLC, so I'm excited about that. I love to see all the weird different monsters and get to test my knowledge of monsters to see if I know which potions and which oils work well against them the first time that I fight them in combat. But as the name would suggest, Blood and Wine, it's very vampire focused, which is very interesting.
Okay.
And vampires are a complicated thing in the Witcher world because they're kind of like humans, like they're intelligent beasts. So it's, as with many things in Witcher 3, morally gray as to like what the right decision is for Geralt to make. So I'm really excited to get into that, but I don't know when I'm going to finish it because Hollow Knight Silksong just dropped after, I think, 7 years in development. What started as a DLC for Hollow Knight, but then they just kept building it and building it until it was a full-fledged sequel. And that's at the current moment absorbing all my attention. But I'm going to wait to talk about that for another time, and hopefully I'll be able to get back to Blood and Wine at some point too and finish that up.
All right, cool. A lot of cool stuff on your plate.
Oh, yeah.
I dig it.
Yeah, but we've got a really cool special topic to talk about too, so why don't we get into that? We are talking about the history of the internet, that magical thing that is letting you and I record and communicate on this podcast, Ben.
That's right.
It's interesting talking about the history or like the birth of the internet because there's no hard date, but many people mark January 1st, 1983 as the beginning, the true beginning of the internet. And I'm going to explain a little bit about the background of everything leading up to this date, and then I'll talk about why that day in particular is the day that it's sort of recognized. And I also want to mention first that the term itself, internet, actually comes from all the way back in 1974. The word had been used before but meant different things. But in 1974, it was used as an abbreviation for the phrase internetwork, meaning the connection of multiple networks of computers. And it was just kind of an idea, I think, at that point, not really put into any sort of practice. But even before 1974, countries had been working on ways to send data between computers. And lots of people have been working on it, but the main players that I'm going to be talking about for the development of the internet as we know it today are the US, the United Kingdom, and France.
You're talking about their militaries?
The U.S. specifically was their military. UK and France, I'm not sure if it was government organizations or not that first started developing the internet, but they kind of had like ideas about how to communicate between the computers that were then adopted elsewhere. I don't know all the details of it, but it may have been some of the military agencies there too. But in the U.S., it definitely was part of the Department of Defense. It was this agency called ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. They, in 1969, contracted some scientists to create a computer network, which was called ARPANET, which we've talked about before. Some of the first games where people could play multiplayer on different computers were on ARPANET. And the U.S. created ARPA, the agency, in response to the Soviets launching Sputnik, the satellite, and realizing that, like, holy crap, they needed to kind of catch up on scientific stuff. So this was one of the ways they responded to create that agency. And one of the things that ARPA did was to create this, like, I don't know if it was the very first, but one of the first and one of the biggest computer networks. And over the years after 1969, different computer networks were created. All of them used different protocols for how the information was communicated between the computers. So that meant that none of these networks on their own could communicate with each other. And as I talked about with like the definition of internet, there was no real internetwork because these networks weren't communicating with each other. So ARPANET was spreading in the US, but there were a bunch of other networks that it couldn't communicate with. ARPANET used a method called packet switching to transmit data, where the information was kind of broken down into smaller pieces of data and then transmitted through multiple channels to arrive at the destination, which means if one of the channels was corrupted and all the data didn't get there, the receiver could tell, you know, they still received part of the file, but the file wasn't complete and they could just ask for it to be transmitted again. Whereas before, like some of the previous methods of communicating between computers, it sent everything all at once and it just wouldn't show up basically, like if it didn't work, instead of them knowing why it didn't work. And so throughout the 70s and the early 80s, different protocols for how these networks communicate were developed. One of them was called TCP/IP, or Transfer Control Protocol and Internet Protocol, which was made by Vinton Cerf and Bob Kahn. This protocol established the IP address, or the Internet Protocol address, for each device on a network. And by each device having that label and some of the other details in these protocols that these guys developed, using this protocol let people resend data automatically if it failed to send instead of it being a manual process. And it also verified when data was accurately sent. So it was a big step forward in kind of protocol for how these networks communicated with each other. And then that leads us to the date that we talked about at the beginning, January 1st of 1983, why we're discussing it today on the podcast. That date is when ARPANET and another big network, the Defense Data Network, which I think was also part of like the Department of Defense, but had different purposes than ARPANET. Those two networks both adopted this new protocol of TCP/IP, allowing a large number of computers to join together using the same protocols for the first time. And in the years following, you know, some networks didn't adopt this protocol and they grew larger and did their own thing, but more and more networks started using the TCP/IP protocols. A bit like saying ATM machine, I guess it's redundant, but TCP/IP. And that's how the internet grows, basically. So that's why some people see, you know, these two big networks joined using the same protocol. So that's why it's seen kind of as the birth of the internet. But yeah, it's a convoluted subject. And that is my layman's review of the history of the internet, because I myself am a layman and I didn't understand many of the details that I was reading. But yeah, we're starting to get there. I think we'll probably start seeing some games, but I think it's going to take a while because this is still very much like a government controlled thing. Like the internet, I don't think is really in the hands of the public quite yet, but we already saw games on ARPANET. So somebody's going to be making games on these mainframe computers or whatever it is, regardless of if the government wants them to, I'm sure.
Yeah, that guy in the Pentagon's actually making Pac-Man for the ARPANET.
Right, exactly. I can't wait till we see something like that because I'm sure it's going to pop up. But either way, it's a huge milestone in the history of video games because it's only a matter of time before we get like Ultima Online and RuneScape and stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's going to be awesome. I think you did a great job, Buzz. That was awesome. But yeah, internet gets invented January 1983. That's where we are. But let's head over into the timeline and actually talk about some games that came out in this month as well. Hello and welcome back to the History of Video Games. We're going to hop into my first review right away today. It's a pretty weird one, but I kind of liked it. It's called Joyful Road. I think that's a Japanese title. It's also known as Munchmobile in the US. But this is a weird game, Wes. Imagine a top-down speed race style game, except your car has like hands. Out of the car. Yeah, they kind of grab things along the side of the road. I feel like it's an idea that could only come out of Japan in the best way. The car also has big eyeballs on it, so it's definitely like a sentient car with big hands. But yeah, I mean, I think the game's pretty self-explanatory, really. You're just driving along this road. It's not necessarily a racing game. I think that's something I thought it was when I first looked at it. It looks just like those top-down racing games from, you know, Taito way back in the day. But it's not really a racing game. There's no real enemies that you're trying to pass. Speed is not really a factor. The screen scrolls at a very constant, pretty slow speed the whole time. So it's not like a speed thing and you're not trying to go fast. You're just trying to not crash, which is pretty hard. And then also collect things on the side of the road using your big hands as a car. The game controls with two joysticks, so you got one joystick to control the movement of the car, which can go left and right, but also up and down the screen, which is a little different from most speed race style games or top-down kind of racing games with a scrolling background, which this has. So you got one joystick for the car, and the other joystick just controls the hands. Basically, if you move that joystick to the left, a hand will come out of the car, like giant hand out of the window kind of thing, and reach over into the side of the grass and try to pick something up, which you don't have to press a button to pick anything up. It's just like if you're in the right spot and kind of pass over it, it'll pick it up. And then you have to, you know, retract the hand back to the car, and that's how you get your points or whatever. You can do it to the left or to the right, but it means that you only have one hand sticking out of the window at any time. You never have both hands because the joystick's only one way or the other. And basically, all you're trying to do is kind of collect things along the side of the road. You do that for extra bonus points. So it's not even like the main part of the game. Like the main part of the game is just not crashing. That's like what you're mainly focused on. But there is fuel canisters along the side of the road. And you do need to pick up, I think, at least one of them to not lose all your fuel within a level. So you need to get at least one of them to finish a level. Maybe two. I'm not sure. I'm sure it gets harder as it goes. But when I was playing, I was like, well, if I can just get the fuel and not crash, I'll be pretty happy. Because everything else is just bonus points, which is like, it's kind of weird to me because like the main mechanic of the game is your car has arms and you're grabbing things. Why wouldn't that be mandatory? But it's really not. Like, you don't have to use it really at all. The actual not crashing your car, it's a top-down racing game with a scrolling screen. So, you know, there's things kind of falling from the top of the screen. But they're pretty easy to avoid. I will say the road you're on feels like it's like a one-lane road. And so when there's something coming down one of the sides, there's only enough room like for you to barely fit in before you touch the edge. And if you just touch the edge of the road, just like by a pixel, it feels like you immediately die and like blow up. So you cannot leave the road. And the hardest part is, I think, actually more so the turns, which in this game are kind of just straight diagonals. And it's one of those games where you kind of push to go diagonal to the right or left. And your car, like, I don't know. It feels like it's like scooching over pixel by pixel. It's not really that you're turning, you know, it just kind of scoots. Especially at the speed that it's going, it's not really going that fast, but it's just the road's very narrow. And if you go outside the road, even just for a second, immediately death. So that's what's kind of hard about it. It's hard because you have to keep looking at what's in front of you to make sure nothing's falling down or that there's no turns, while also looking at the sides of the screen to pick stuff up with your hands. That's actually what makes the game hard, because you have to split your attention. It's hard to pick stuff up with the hands a lot of the time because there's a lot of just obstacles along the side of the road, like trees or rocks or something. And if your hand hits them, it'll automatically retract and like get red as if you like whacked it on something. And it just like disables it for a second, which isn't a big deal. But they put like fuel, you know, like in between two mailboxes, and it's like pixel perfect. You gotta like reach your hand in there right at the right time and then retract it, or else you'll hit the mailbox with your hand. So it can be pretty tight with the grabbing of the objects. As far as like what you can grab for bonus points, it's mostly like food related items. There are bags of money though as well. And there is a section where you kind of drive over like bridges and fish come up out of the water. You can catch them in midair, which I think is cool. Once you grab a piece of food and retract your arm to the car, once you extend it again, it'll actually extend the food as a like piece of garbage item, like a apple core, right? If you kind of grabbed an apple, if you like move your hand to retract it again, it'll drop the apple core wherever it was. Most of the time that's totally fine to do, but there are trash cans scattered along the road where if you drop the food item into the trash can, you get even more bonus points.
Oh, nice.
But it's just another extra layer to the challenge. There is a beginning, middle, and end to every level. At the end of the level, you do pull into a driveway, and then there's a little cutscene of like two people in a heart around them. So I guess you were driving home from a long day at work or something. And then the next level starts. The levels, the backgrounds, I think, are all pretty much the same, although there are a couple new mechanics in some of the later levels. Like the main one I noticed is that you start running into intersections, which the cars in the intersection are moving like crazy fast, and it's basically like a wall, like you can't pass it. It kind of forces you to wait until your light turns green, and then you have to quick jump to the other side of the intersection while the screen is scrolling. So it's just another kind of obstacle, but I thought it was a pretty cool one. So yeah, I think that's pretty much all you need to know about the gameplay to Joyful Road. I did play the original Japanese version, so I'll be calling it that. But let's move into the ratings for this one. I thought it was pretty good. It's pretty enjoyable. Let's start off with the gameplay, because I ended up playing this quite a bit more than I needed to. I just kind of wanted to get to the end of level one. I knew I could do it, and I just really wanted to try to get there. But I kept losing on fuel and then running into the side of the road because I was looking at the hand and not noticing that the road was turning and stuff. So it was kind of hard, but I did get there. I thought it was quite fun. Even though it's not fast, it's not like a racing game, even though there's a racing car that you're driving. It's more like a something that just kind of keeps your attention by always having tons of things around you that you have to worry about. Mostly trying to sneak the hand into really hard to get places while turning the car at the same time is pretty difficult. But I thought it was a nice, fun challenge, something that's quite different from anything else we've ever seen. So I thought that was fun. And it's kind of a cute game, and it was, I don't know, I kind of liked it. So it is a bit repetitive, and I do not like the fact that the hands are mostly there just to get fuel, and otherwise you don't really need to use them. I feel like maybe all the food should have been fuel or something, and you had to get like five of them to get to the end of level. But it's okay. It is really hard to get a lot of the stuff with the hand as well. A lot of times I just think, like, I see a piece of food like stuck right in between two bushes. I'm like, how would you ever get that? It feels like it's impossible. I don't know if they're supposed to be red herrings or what. I will say, I think after playing a while that the levels are not randomly generated. So I think you could get pretty good at just memorizing the route and what you need to pick up, which I think it would take away a little bit of the game. I think it would be better if it was randomly generated. But still, I had quite a bit of fun with this one. I'm not saying it's like going to be game of the year or anything, but I give it a 3.75 out of 10
okay.
for the gameplay. I think it's pretty solid, pretty different, and enjoyable. All right, let's move on to the graphics. I gave that a 3.5 out of 10. They're decent, but I don't think there's anything like too crazy about them. The car is obviously quite weird with eyeballs and the big hands, and I love it, but I don't feel the same way about it as I do about like my Sprite Hall of Fame nominees. I think it could have been even cuter. I'm not sure how, but I don't know. It's not as memorable as some of the other things. And yeah, the stuff that you pick up is just not that interesting. It's like food and some fuel. Everything is multicolored Sprite. Everything has nice shading and detail, but a lot of the screen is just a solid color, like green, you know, kind of grass background for a lot of the edges. I think the water looks quite good, and the fish is one of my favorite parts that jumps out of the water. There's also these bridges that you go under, or like they're more like tunnels, but the tunnels are kind of partially see-through, so you can see your car through them, which is something I've never really seen before. And I thought that was really cool, but I kind of just wish you could like drive through, I don't know, a desert level and a night level, you know, kind of have a little bit more variety instead of mostly just bright green the whole time. There is like a dark green level, which I guess is their version of night, but it's really not that different. So I thought what's there is really nice, but I don't know. I just was hoping for a little bit more. So I gave that a 3.5 out of 10. For the sound effects, it's kind of interesting. I don't think anything is like super strong, but something I noticed that I feel like we never see in games is that within the same level, there were multiple musical tracks. I think just two, but I could definitely distinctly hear a music track starting, going for a while, and then legit fading out and a new song starting in a level, which I don't think has like ever really happened before. Like if anything, maybe one track has like a level or a piece of music and then a different track is a different piece of music. But yeah, I've never heard like a fade out in the middle of a level. So that was kind of interesting. This is kind of the same two pieces of music for every level. So I don't know, maybe it just evens out a little bit, but it's still different and gave a little bit of variety. The music is also definitely not as loud in the mix, which I thought was kind of nice. So it didn't get on my nerves at all. I think one of them is definitely like a classical tune, but otherwise the sound effects or just the basic gameplay wasn't that interesting. There's not really like too much of an engine noise, which is what I would expect when you're driving a car. It's more like, I don't know, high-pitched beeps and stuff that reminds me more of like a Pac-Man kind of vibe. But still, overall, I thought it was pretty decent. I gave the sound effects a 3.75 as well. For relevance, I gave that a 5.5 out of 10. Unfortunately, Joyful Road, while it's by SNK, which is, I would say, on the larger side of as a company, it's still not like that relevant. And there's not a lot of evidence that this one lasted that long. Overall, I gave it a 3.75 out of 10. I think it's quite good. It's not as good as like the top hitters from last year, but if this is what like an average game looks like in 83, I think I'd be pretty happy with that. It definitely feels one tier above the average arcade game of 82, so I'm pretty happy, and it's pretty weird.
I mean, we love weird.
Yeah
that looks wild. I was looking up some pictures of it, and sounds like a decent game. And just fun theming, like a fun theme helps go a long way. All right, but as I mentioned, there was a U.S. release of this as well called Munchmobile by Century. And then that will take me to my first review of the day, another arcade cabinet. We have New Sinbad 7 by ATW. Sometime in 1983 it came out. We're putting it here in January. Interesting game name, and the U.S. flyer art for this is even more interesting. I mean, it's fantastic. There's this character of Sinbad 7, I guess is your character's name, who's just this crazy looking robot man with like a I mean, Sinbad is like sort of like mythology figure from like Middle East. So
with a name like Sinbad, my mind immediately goes to pirates for some reason. I don't know.
Well, he was sort of like a, I was looking it up. He's like in the lore, I guess, from Baghdad originally, but he was like a seafarer. So I think he is also kind of like a hero pirate, you know? But yeah, so Sinbad 7, but yeah, he's a futuristic robot with like a Middle Eastern kind of saber. And that's it.
Okay.
Like, it reminds me of like Jet Jaguar from like the Japanese, like old school Japanese TV show and all that. In the flyer art, he also has a giant key in his hand. Behind him, there's a floating island, dragons, crazy birds. It looks awesome. And I think the whole theming of the number 7 is that they had like 14 levels, because it says like on the text, 7 sorcerers summoned him 7 times and then 7 times again or something like that. Like,
okay.
Really random. And I was also looking up ATW because I was just curious about what that was. And it was a Taiwanese company that had a US branch. So it did get like a local US release. And yeah, like I said, I don't know too much about Sinbad the character, but the game doesn't really seem to follow the mythology necessarily anyway. It's just kill monsters and get treasure. So to give a little bit more detail to the gameplay, New Sinbad 7 is a top-down, four-directional maze shooter. So parts of it play like Pac-Man with enemies chasing you through the maze, but it's also kind of more on the side of like Wizard of War because you're shooting back at the enemies and the enemies are shooting at you. On each level, there's a temple or like pyramid sort of building in the center that takes up a large majority of the center of the screen. And there's an item in the center of that pyramid. It's basically like a flat picture. It's not like you have to like enter it in any sort of way, but bits of the picture get taken away as you kill enemies. So sometimes it'll be like the stairs get taken away and then there's a path in the maze that you can take to get the treasure in the center after you kill enough enemies. To kill the enemies, you can shoot in front of you, but as I mentioned, the enemies can also shoot you back. But thankfully, you can hit their bullets, so if you just spam firing most of the time, you're good. And you can fire 2 shots on screen at a time, but since it's pretty close quarters in the maze, it does feel like you can fire pretty fast. The item in the center of the temple, it can either be a key or it can be just some other random item. If it's some other random piece of treasure, you get points and you progress to the next stage. But if it's a key, it opens a door somewhere on the map, which then transports you to another type of level that you have to complete to get the treasure. On these levels, if you go through a door after getting the key, it's basically like a illustration sort of that's like made up of like these little like dot sort of shapes shows up and you just have to blow up the whole thing. Like one time it was like a little sailboat and I had to like shoot the sailboat and destroy all of them to beat the stage. But the blocks will break off occasionally and turn red and bounce all around the screen, potentially killing you. So you just kind of have to avoid those, shoot all the blocks, and then eventually destroy all the enemy balls or blocks as well to progress to the next level. But that's basically it. You're just going through each of these mazes, trying to get the treasure in the center of the screen, and occasionally doing these side levels when you get a key instead of a piece of treasure. I feel like they are set levels too, like they're not randomized. And like I said, based on the flyer, I think maybe there's 14 unique levels, but it seems like they all play out fairly similarly. So let me get into my ratings now for New Sinbad 7. For graphics, I gave it a 3 out of 10. It's got some really cool flyer art for sure, but it doesn't quite come through in the actual game. There's lots of nice bright colors that I really enjoyed, but the top-down view of Sinbad, he does not look like the cool robot guy that he looks like on the flyer. He looks like a sea turtle because for some reason they like did top-down where it's not just like head and shoulders, but it's like head, arms, lower half of the body, and legs facing outward. So it looks like he's crawling on the ground instead of like standing upright.
Yeah.
And I honestly did think it was a turtle the first time I saw the game. I didn't realize it was supposed to be like a guy. He doesn't really have a sword either, and you're also shooting bullets, so I don't know. All that kind of went out the window, I guess, in the actual game phase of it, or the flyer probably came second, more likely, and they were just like, hey, this looks cool. The enemies are also kind of weird. They're just like strange geometric shapes that kind of like blink and change slightly as they move around. They look okay, but I just wish, you know, the cool dragon that I had seen on the flyer was there or something like that, and maybe it does show up in later levels and I missed it, but from what I saw, it seemed like a lot of just random like lines and colorful shapes. I think my favorite element graphically is definitely the temple structure in the center. It looks like this big building with pillars and sphinx-like statues on either side of it. Very cool. Feels almost a bit out of place with how well detailed it is compared to the rest of the screen. But all in all, it's very bright and colorful and not a bad looking game at all. Moving on to sounds, I only gave this a 2.5 out of 10. The sounds are decent, but there's no real standouts. There's just kind of some basic music, some okay shooting sounds, and some okay explosion sounds. All of them are very sci-fi-ish, which I guess kind of works with the weird hybrid kind of theme they're going for, but none of it was great. And then for gameplay, I gave this a 2.75 out of 10. I wanted to go higher on this, but it just was just okay. The shooting feels all right and quick enough in the maze sections, but as soon as you get to the wide open sections where you're destroying like the blocks or balls or whatever, two shots on screen at a time feels very slow, especially when you're fighting the bouncing enemies that just go super fast and like it just ends up being pretty hard to hit them. And another part of that is that they're very unpredictable. It feels like sometimes they bounce off of where a block was before you destroyed it, because they'll just bounce off of like blank space and then go in a completely unpredictable direction and then ricochet into you. So that was a little frustrating with that stage. And they could also accelerate to like crazy speed sometimes randomly. But I will say the main maze mechanic and gameplay I liked a lot. I think it's cool that you have to kill a certain amount of enemies to open a path to the treasure in the center. And I also think the key that leads you to like a different level where you have to go through an open door, depending on what door opened, like all that's very fun and cool, but it just kind of didn't all meld together to be super interesting. And there weren't really enough differences in the different levels. And the bullets that the enemy shot were literally like one pixel big and they were so tiny. You could barely see them. So if you're spamming and a bullet happens to make it through, it kind of feels like it's all just luck at that point. So decently fun, but lacking in a couple areas. That's why I ended up giving it a 2.75.
Yeah, I think we should mention the maze that you're in. There's enough room where you can like go side to side within a hallway, which I feel like is different from most like Pac-Man style stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not like the bullet has to like hit you. Like you could dodge it to the side, and that's what makes it kind of feel random.
Yeah, which was good and bad. Like, I feel like I'm so used to the Pac-Man style that I was expecting just to like shoot down a pathway and be able to hit anything in my path. But yeah, it's almost like there's two lanes in each pathway that you could fit into. So it's cool, but just felt a little bit strange, but still very unique. Moving on to relevance, I gave it a 3 out of 10. It's an interesting combo of genres for sure, but it's nothing all that new and definitely wasn't a super popular game. So unfortunately, that only left me with a 2.75 out of 10 for New Sinbad 7. It's a game with a crazy title and a weird theme, and definitely has some redeeming qualities I think is worth checking out, taking a look at for sure. Has some nice art and sections and some decent gameplay, but the overall package was definitely kind of dragged down by some of its more like mediocre sounds and visuals. Still a fun one, and I mean, Robo Dude with a saber is always cool, but I just kind of wish that it had come through a bit more in the actual game.
Yeah, the sea turtle sprite's not, that's not a good one.
It's not doing it for me. If it was actually a sea turtle, I might be into it, but
the arms are just weird. I don't know, his like elbows like above his head.
It's like curved that happens backwards, like almost as if he had like a robe on and really long sleeves, or like, I don't know. It's all a bit confusing for sure.
All right, well, another one down though. New Sinbad 7. All right, I'll definitely check it out.
Oh yeah.
Let's keep it going, though, Wes. We've got a couple more arcade games to go through today. The next one here is called Portraits by Olympia. Came out sometime in 1983, and it's not emulated, so we have pretty little information on it, but it was some kind of hunting game, I thought. So, just want to mention that one.
All right, and then the next one we have here is Jet Boot Jack by Dynamis Marketing GmbH and English Software in the UK. This one came out for the Atari 8-bit, and it was a simple like Pac-Man slash ladder game about collecting musical notes But your guy uses like these hover boots that are super cool. There's also some platforming and enemies you can stomp on and sold really well.
All right, but that's going to move me into my second review of the day. It's a computer game and it's a text adventure.
Oh,
our
boy.
First of the year. I'll tell you, Wes, after doing a lot of research of 83, I don't think there's as many text adventures as I would have thought. There's a lot of repeats of like previous ones, just on new pieces of hardware, and that's not that exciting. And this one's kind of a repeat too. I believe this text adventure, which is called The Institute, originally came out in 1981 on the TRS-80. I think we did do an honorable mention on it at that time, but it had no graphics, and now here in 1983, the graphical version has released. So that's what I'll be reviewing today. It's the same kind of story, but with the graphics, it helps so much and kind of put yourself into this world. And there is a bit of a world. That's kind of the reason why I wanted to take a look at this one. It's a very story-heavy text adventure. It's called The Institute, and sure enough, your main goal is to escape an insane asylum. As you do that, you kind of have these hallucinations, and that gives the creators of the text adventure some opportunity to go to some weird places like Dinosaur Land and stuff like that. I think what's kind of cool about it is the puzzle solving for some of these hallucinations is like, I need to die to escape the hallucination, which I feel like in most text adventures, you never want to die because that's just like resets the whole game. So I don't know. I thought it was kind of cool and different. But yeah, the main kind of story is that you're in an insane asylum. You're trying to get out. As the story progresses, it's a pretty linear type of story, right? Like you try to have certain escapes, but it's all part of the story and you end up like getting caught and then getting thrown into like a padded cell. Then you need to like get out of that or like hide things, items in the cell so that when you get thrown in there again, you can do like more stuff with it and stuff like that. You take certain medicines and that gives you these hallucinations. It's a little bit of a morbid story, we'll say. Like it's got some, it's a little bit darker than most of the things that are coming out in 1983, but it's very unique and different. And I thought it was definitely worth talking about. It's pretty rare just to have a graphical text adventure where like you need to die, you know, like to escape something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It also meant that, you know, as far as I can tell, I don't think there's really any like mazes per se in the game. There is definitely a parser and there's some issues with the parser and also like issues with the graphics where the graphics help so much put you into the space, but sometimes they don't tell you everything you need to know. Like I think in one place I was reading the Blue Ranga blog who did a write up on the Institute, specifically the graphical text adventure version. And like, I think for one of the rooms, he had to listen in the room and it said, oh, you hear dripping water. Well, how would you ever know that?
Right.
Unless you were just listening in every room. But he's obviously an expert and knew to try that. But I would never get that. It doesn't seem like it's that long of a text adventure. There are some of the hallucinations are apparently only like 3 or 4 rooms large. So, you know, I think Blue Ranga was a little disappointed because it didn't feel like it lived up to the potential of what it could have been. And I do agree with that, but I still thought it was kind of cool. I think there's a lot of common text adventure tropes that it avoids, like big mazes and, you know, like times when you're in a barbershop and you step outside and you're in the Roman Colosseum. Like,
right,
I felt
right.
like that happens so many times in the early text adventures. And this is like a linear story that kind of makes sense room to room. I'm not saying it makes total sense, but it makes some sense. So, you know, to me, I thought it was definitely worth covering. I still tried to play it and pretty much got nowhere. So they're still too hard for me. I will say with it, everything more or less having a picture, I don't know that I would have had to have done a maze or like written down like a maze kind of map that connects all the rooms for this, because it feels like it's more or less pretty linear. And it's not trying to be a maze. It's more like a interactive story with a bunch of puzzles, right?
Right.
So I think we're kind of getting a little bit closer to the...
like point and click adventures?
Point and clicks, yeah. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. Of course, we don't still have a mouse in 1983, but eventually. The only other thing I want to mention that was very annoying is that you can't, for most of the versions, this came out, by the way, on the Atari 8-bit, Apple II, and Commodore 64. But I think on every one of the versions, actually, the pictures were not on screen with the parser. So you would type in your parser command, it would draw the picture to like say like, oh, you see a bottle. And then the picture goes away and it's just black with the text. What do you want to do? You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. you can't type stuff in while looking at the picture, which is kind of annoying. That was maybe one downside to it. But I think overall, the graphics are quite good. There's a good amount of detail. I think, weirdly, the color palettes are pretty limited. I don't know why that is. It seems like every picture only has like two colors in it, even if there's like four shades of that color, you know, like maybe there's a dark blue, a medium blue, and a light blue, but for the whole picture, it will only use blue and yellow. And I don't know why that is. It's like that in every version. My guess is that one of the computers, there's a limitation like that, like maybe the Apple II version, and they just copied it over to the other versions, even though the other versions could do more colors on screen. I don't know. I kind of think the Atari 8-bit version looks the best, but they have this dithering effect that it does make the pictures look like they have a lot of detail, especially from a distance. But if you like zoom in, or if you have the game on full screen, you can see each pixel of the dither, and it kind of makes the whole thing look like it's on like a weird checkerboard pattern.
Right. So, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of like at times I kind of think, wow, that looks really good. And then at times I'm like, maybe it doesn't look that good. I think the character designs are pretty good. They're a little cartoony because you're kind of imagining a lot of things. Like, I think there's a guy in a scuba suit. I don't know why he's here. And like a bird that talks to you, maybe. But yeah, you know, on one hand, I think the graphics are really good. On the other hand, I think they're not as good as they could be. So where does that leave me? Let's go to the scores. Let's start out with the graphics. I ended up giving them a 3.5 out of 10. I think they're pretty good. There's a lot of different pictures. They have usually lots of shading to them, partially with some of the dithering, partially done with like multiple different shades of the color itself. And it just helps make everything have a little bit more complexity to it and intrigue. And so I thought overall the graphics are pretty good, even if the color palette is a bit limited. So I was pretty happy with it. Gave it a 3.5 out of 10. For the gameplay, I gave that a 3.25 out of 10. It still has some problems. You know, I can't really advance past like the third screen, but I do like that it's a little bit more linear. I like that it doesn't have some of the annoying things that a lot of text adventures have, like needing to be written down on a piece of paper, you know, as much, needing to have to worry about like getting lost in a infinite maze, you know, stuff mm-hmm. like this. And having like deaths on every single screen if you don't do the exact right thing. So I think it's a little bit better in that respect, but it's still, you know, it has one answer. Once you solve it, you know it. And it's still kind of hard, and the parser's not great. I wish the parser was on screen with the pictures, and there are some really weird verb noun combinations you have to know to escape this insane asylum. All right, but then the sounds, unfortunately, will bring it down, though.
So, right.
There are some sounds in this game in some of the versions, right? I think it was the Atari 8-bit version. It might have been the Commodore 64 version. There's a piece of music that actually plays once you start up the game. And it's pretty short, and it does repeat itself, which is kind of annoying. But I thought that that was kind of nice. But unfortunately, once you start the game, there is no music. There is like a terrifying like whistle sound that plays every now and then. And of course, the game's completely silent in between these whistles. So as soon as it actually plays something, it freaks me out every time, just because it's completely deathly silent otherwise. So there is some sounds, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's good or present very much in the game. So I just gave the sound effects a 1.5 out of 10. It's mostly silent, so couldn't go high there. For relevance, didn't seem like it was all that relevant. I think it has a bit of a cult following. It's got definitely a weird subject matter to it with this insane asylum stuff, but I don't think it's like super relevant. Didn't find much evidence that it existed long term. So just gave it a 5 out of 10 for relevance. And that overall left me with a 2.75 out of 10 for the Institute. I kind of wish they just had some music and it would just have gotten such a better score, but it's mostly silent. I do think we're on the right track, though. You know, it's a little bit more story based. It's a little bit more straightforward and kind of linear, but it's still dealing with some issues. And I'm hoping that eventually we can get to some games that use like all the colors in the color palette. Would be nice, and have a bit more resolution. But overall, it's not too bad. I was happy to take a look at it.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. But and you know, it's a shame because we definitely have seen graphic text adventures where the parser and the image are on screen at the same time.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing is there, you're sacrificing the real estate of the image. But I don't know. You think it'd be better because they don't have to redraw it every time? Or maybe, I don't know. Who knows? But still, it sounds like an interesting game and for sure an interesting concept. So very cool. I'm glad you played it. All right, let's move on though. We've got a few more honorable mentions here. My last review for today as well. But first, we're going to talk about Orc Attack by Creative Sparks and Thorn EMI. This one was for the Atari 8-bit, and it was a very simple game where you defend the top of a wall, but the graphics were pretty sweet, and it has a certain charm to it.
Yep, and the next one here is called Rocks, as in rock music or something. R-O-C-C-K, or like actual rock.
Like actual rocks.
It's by Douglas Engel. Came out sometime in 1983 for the Atari 8-bit, and it's a simple Lunar Lander dodging type game. But man, the graphics of this are really good. I swear, the Atari 8-bit is just getting better and better every year somehow. It's just like unlocking a new high-res mode or something. I don't know what's going on. But yeah, it looks really good.
Someone found the secret button that gives it more pixels. And they're like, oh, why didn't we just hit that? All right, but now we are going to talk about my second review of the day. Again, still in the computer game section. This one is called Changer by Random House. And it's for the Sharp X1 computer, which is pretty cool. I don't think we've ever reviewed a game for the Sharp X1. Unfortunately, for the history of this game, there is none that I could find. Not too much going on other than that it was published by Random House and developed by two people named Kenji Kawachi and Ai Shizuka. Changer, though, is a really strange and unique game that I would kind of say is a combo of like Locomotion, the sliding block train game, and Qbert. You play as a girl in a maze with 40 different blocks, like sort of like floor tiles, I guess, think of them as. And there are maze walls dividing all the different floor tiles into different sections. Your main objective of the game is to walk on all of the tiles that change the color of the blocks, hence the Qbert connection there. And then some of the tiles, you know, they're totally walled off, but the way you get around that is you have the ability to flip rows. So it's almost like a sliding block puzzle, like Locomotion, except instead of sliding the rows down, you like totally reverse them. It took me like 5 minutes of staring at a video of somebody playing this game to understand what was actually happening, because it kind of looks like you're just switching like two things, but I'm 98% sure that it's flipping the rows, and that's what's happening. So in that kind of sense, I mean, you can flip the vertical or horizontal rows. So it's almost like a Rubik's Cube, kind of, if you think of like a 5x8 Rubik's Cube, because I think it's a 5x8 grid and you're sort of flipping things to get the maze walls where they need to be so that you can walk on all of the floor tiles. But you also flip yourself. So I think it could have just been the people I watched play this. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get this emulated to play it myself. But everyone I watched play it, they could only flip a row that they were in. So they flip themselves whenever they flip that too. So you all like not only have to take into account the walls you're moving, but also have to take into account where you're going to end up. So it's very confusing, but very cool and puzzly. While you're switching blocks around or switching these rows around, there's also an enemy that sort of looks like a policeman. I don't know. I think I read somebody say that they think it's like a kid dressed up as like a policeman or something. I don't know. But they will try to chase you through this maze and they will always follow you, but it's pretty easy to like trap them in the maze walls when you flip these different rows. You have 3 lives. You lose a life if the police kid, I guess, catches up to you. And there's multiple levels to go through. Every level, it changes like the color that you have to change the tile to, basically just changes to make it more interesting. And the maze walls, I believe, are also set up in slightly different places each level that you go through. But that is the basic description of it. So now let me tell you a little bit more about how it looked and how it sounded and all that good stuff. For graphics, I gave this a 3 out of 10. It's a computer game, and I kind of expected the colors would be flat, which they are, but there's some nice variety in the colors and some quote-unquote dithering. I mean, the pixels are pretty big, so it's almost like you were saying with the Institute, Ben, it's more like a checkerboard than like small enough that it actually looks like a new color. But there is some colors that have that sort of like speckled dot sort of thing going on, gives it some visual interest. The little girl that you play as is really well detailed. She has like multiple colors to the sprite, including blue hair with a dithering effect, a yellow like either bow or flower in the hair, and a red school backpack, and I think 4 different sprites or 3 different sprites for like sideways, up, and down, depending on which way you're walking. She was probably the most interesting visual part of the game. She looks pretty awesome. And then the police kid guy looks okay too. He looks like he has a red nose though, and he definitely has like a, you know, like a Batman and Robin, like a Robin face mask over his eyes. So he's just kind of weird looking, but other than that, pretty good. And then I also like the flip animation for when you switch each row around, a bit of a throwback, but the best way I can describe it is that it looks like when you turn off an old TV and it's the flash of white that shrinks into black, if you know what I mean, like an old CRT.
Mm-hmm.
It basically does that, except it's isolated that effect within whichever row you're switching. So it's this big like flash of white, and then it kind of like stretches, and it's doing things that feel like a PC in 1983 shouldn't be able to like render, like, because it's not 3D, but it just looks so weird and non like geometric. It's just like this weird like blink that like morphs and then shrinks. So it's very strange. I don't know what the heck's going on with that, but it looks really cool and feels like otherworldly, you know, like it feels like you're manipulating time and space when you do it, which I guess is sort of the effect. Also, when you complete a level, the little girl walks off to the side of the screen and then does like a little bow, which is pretty cool. And then unfortunately, I mean, it's nice that there's more animations, but the animation when you die is that this like kid dressed up as a policeman flashes you. It's horrible. That's how you die. So I don't like that part so much, but the other graphical effects of this were pretty interesting and really good, especially when you're considering that this is a computer. So I enjoyed that quite a lot. The sounds, thankfully, were really good in this as well. I gave them a 3.5 out of 10. There's some really impressive music going on. The main audio is this musical track that plays through the whole game, and it's a bit repetitive, but it definitely has, you know, like maybe 20 seconds or 25 seconds of length, so it's not too bad. And it's 2 voices, so you have like a little bass line and then a melody playing. It sounds like some classical song, I don't know, but then after you win around, it definitely plays like some variation of London Bridge is Falling Down, which I thought was pretty good too. So, you know, it's not like exciting songs, but it's done really well, again, especially considering that it's on a computer. Yeah, I was just really impressed by that. The only other main noise in the game is the like flipping noise when you're changing around a row. That works pretty well. It's like this kind of spacey, futuristic noise. The only problem I have with it is that it does stop the music. So it's like taking up the sound channels, I guess, whenever it happens. And that's a little disorienting, but overall, it still sounded really good. Gameplay, though, this unfortunately, I mean, again, I didn't get to play it, but from what I was seeing, it didn't seem like it would be a ton of fun to play. The puzzle aspect of Changer is really interesting, and I like how the rows flip to switch it up from just being like a sliding puzzle block game But the visuals, I feel like, make it really hard to easily discern, like, what's going on and where you need to flip stuff to open the paths. Like I said, it took me like 5 minutes of watching to even understand what was happening with the flipping. The walls are kind of like bright colors and they sort of blend in with the rest of the stuff going on. And it's just a very disorienting. Like I wish there was almost like a black grid line in between all of the different tiles on the screen so that you could see what's going on. But when everything's the same color and you haven't changed it yet, it all just kind of blends together and was a bit hard to see what's going on. But I do think the puzzle aspect of it was pretty cool. I just also wish there was more variation in the levels, some more. Eventually there are more enemies, but it doesn't seem like the maze layout changes very much. Like it doesn't get any bigger. It's just the same size and the color changes and the walls might change a little bit. So very cool concept. I'm not sure how well it was executed. I landed on a 2.5 out of 10 for gameplay. Still cool, and I would love to see something else try to do this, but I just need like a little bit clearer visuals so I can actually solve the puzzle instead of what it looked like was everyone I saw playing it was just guessing. You know, they were just like smashing the button until they solved it, and it'd be fun to actually be able to plan ahead and solve it a little bit more easily. For relevance, though, I gave it a 4 out of 10. Changer was very hard to find info on, and it doesn't seem like it was very popular, but I think it does deserve at least a tiny bit of relevance cred for being a really unique game that we haven't seen before. And overall, that left me with a 3 out of 10 for Changer. The gameplay is really novel and interesting, but the graphics, as good as they were, kind of made things a bit confusing sometimes. And the gameplay, I didn't mention this before, but it was also very slow. You're like, your character just kind of walks very slowly to each tile, so it took a bit of time. One person I saw the first level took them like 25 minutes. I was like, wow, that's, I don't know if that's the pace that I want for a game like this. The whole package, I think, is definitely really impressive for a computer game. Makes me curious to see what else is going to come out on the Sharp X1. That was kind of one that I had written off, wasn't on my radar. You know, that's up there with like the Spectrum now. My interest of like, okay, this is a color computer with sound that could maybe do some cool stuff.
I think you're going to like it, Wes. I mean, the X1, I think we covered in December last year, so I really didn't get chance to really show off what it can do. But yeah, I'm excited, man.
I mean, this is a good first showing for it, especially in the sound and graphics department.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was cool. Very different. A puzzle game. So probably one of your favorites, right?
We'll see about you.
But let's keep it going. We've got one more computer game here today. It's called Warriors of Ross Volume 3 The Wild, spelled wrong. Wild spelled with a Y. It came out sometime in 1983 for the Atari 8-bit, Commodore 64, TRS-80, and the Apple II. It's the third RPG in the Dungeon series, but it's spelled, again, wrong with a Z in there. Dunzin. This time, though, it featured a more traditional world map that you could kind of go between for dungeons, and the combat was still super slow though, so we decided not to do this one, but it is interesting. I think they're taking some ideas from Ultima and Wizardry with that.
Okay. I think that's a good place to take inspiration from, so be happy to see more games doing stuff like that. All right, but now we're going to wrap things up with two games from the Intellivision. The first one is Dragonfire. Came out in January. This is one that I really enjoyed playing on the Atari 2600, and the Intellivision port is basically just better. There's also a VIC-20 port this year that's pretty decent. If you don't remember, it's sort of running back and forth, dodging literal dragon fire, and then collecting a bunch of treasure.
Yep. And then the last one for today is called Sharpshoot, which also came out in January for the Intellivision. It's a collection of four shooting-themed games. Kind of reminds me of the older home console games that had like 70 variations on them from the Atari 2600 way back when came out. But this has four different shooting-themed games. My favorite, though, is actually a football-themed passing game. I thought that was kind of cool.
Nice.
But yeah, the four games are completely different theming, so I thought it was kind of different and wanted to mention it.
Very cool.
But that will do it for us today. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. We did Joyful Road, a game about being a car with hands and eating food or something. It was pretty fun and different and definitely a highlight for me. We then took a look at New Sinbad 7, which was kind of like a Pac-Man game, but you could also shoot things. I did The Institute, which was a graphical text adventure with a pretty morbid theming, I guess, but it was still pretty cool. And then, Wes, you did Changer by Random House, a game on the Sharp X1 out of Japan. It was kind of like Pac-Man mixed with Q-Bert mixed with a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah.
Very unique and different.
Yeah, and if you guys have enjoyed this, you know, we're loving getting into 1983, getting our research, just about done, tightening things up, and we're excited for you guys to keep joining us on these episodes. So make sure to check out our website where we've got tons of information on stuff we've covered before, and you can see the fruits of all this research. Also, make sure to follow us on X, where we post announcements about our episodes when they're going up and if we need to take a break. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.